Hi everyone, I'm Shyam and I'll be talking to you about secure in-band wireless pairing. This is joint work with my colleagues Nabil, Nikolai and Dina. Establishing a secure connection between two wireless devices is an important problem. We run into it when you're trying to pair our laptop with our wireless router, the Bluetooth headset with a cell phone, or even the medical sensor with its reader. The goal of secure pairing is to ensure that an adversary cannot get access to either your laptop, your headset, or your medical sensor. Traditional solutions to achieve this require the user to enter or validate some kind of a shared key, such as a password. However, having the user to enter or validate passwords is difficult for two main reasons. First, ordinary users often struggle with picking long and random passwords. Instead, they pick easy to remember passwords, which can be easily broken. Second, even if the user can pick the right kind of a password, there are a number of devices which do not have the interface to enter these passwords. This includes devices such as the headphones, medical sensors, and home surveillance sensors. So the problem we consider is, how do we achieve secure pairing without having the user to enter or validate passwords? Here's a tentative solution. Let's use a Diffie-Hellman key exchange. In particular, say we have Alice and Bob. Alice is first going to transmit her Diffie-Hellman message. Bob is going to reply back with his Diffie-Hellman message, and the shared key is constructed using the two exchange messages. The problem with this approach is that wireless is an open medium, and therefore anyone can transmit and receive on it. So an adversary can simply sit on the wireless medium and mount the well-known man-in-the-middle attack. All he has to do is simply impersonate Alice and transmit his own Diffie-Hellman message and pair with Bob. In fact, just 2 days back, there was a full-fledged man-in-the-middle attack at DEFCON. Today, there are two approaches to secure pairing without passwords. On one hand, the industry has come up with solutions which require the user to simply push buttons on the two devices to initiate the Diffie-Hellman pairing. This includes solutions such as push button configuration from Wi-Fi or even the simple pairing protocol from Bluetooth. The problem with this approach is that all they do is the Diffie-Hellman exchange, and therefore they're susceptible to the man-in-the-middle attack. On the other hand, the academic community has come up with a number of interesting solutions which use trusted out-of-band channels like cameras and displays, audio channels, tactile channels, or even infrared channels. Since these channels are not accessible to an adversary, these solutions are secure from man-in-the-middle attacks. The problem with this approach, however, is that it might be infeasible to include these out-of-band channels in small devices such as home and medical sensors for both size and cost requirements. Ideally, we need a solution which is the best of both worlds. That is, it's secure from man-in-the-middle attacks and also does not require any out-of-band channels. We're going to introduce tamper-evident pairing, or TEP. TEP is the first in-band secure pairing protocol. TEP is secure from man-in-the-middle attacks, but does not require any out-of-band channels or user passwords. We formally prove that TEP is secure from man-in-the-middle attacks. We also show that TEP can work on existing 802.11 cards and operating systems. Finally, we implement and evaluate TEP on operational Wi-Fi networks. All right, so how do we protect from man-in-the-middle attacks without requiring any out-of-band channels? The main reason why man-in-the-middle attacks happen is because messages can be tampered on the wireless medium. Prior work assumes that an attacker can arbitrarily tamper with wireless messages, and therefore, they do not trust any wireless messages and opt for out-of-band channels to solve the problem. We're going to take a completely different approach. We're going to look more carefully at what's really happening on the wireless medium to gain an understanding of how wireless tampering happens. With this understanding, we're going to devise mechanisms to detect tampering when it happens. Now that we can detect tampering, we can trust untampered messages and use them for secure pairing. At a very high level, we are going to collect all the messages received within a window of time and pair only if we receive one exact pairing message and do not detect any tampering. But before we go into these details, let's first see how an adversary can tamper with wireless messages. Say, Alice is transmitting her Diffie-Hellman message to Bob. The adversary can tamper with this message in three ways. First, the adversary can alter this message to match its own Diffie-Hellman message. Second, the adversary can hide the fact that Alice sent the message. Finally, the adversary can prevent Alice from sending this message in the first place. First, let's see how an adversary can alter the message. The simplest way to do this is, say this is the Alice's signal, the adversary is going to transmit a much higher power at the same time. Now, Alice's signal is going to look like noise, and therefore Bob is going to decode the adversary's altered message. Next, in order to hide Alice's message, an adversary is going to transmit at the same time as Alice and create a collision at Bob. Since collisions are typical events in wireless networks, Bob is going to ignore this collision and hence miss the fact that Alice sent the message. Now the adversary can send his own pairing message and pair with Bob. Finally, an adversary can prevent this message from being sent by simply occupying the channel all the time. Since 802.11 devices wait for the wireless channel to be free before transmitting, Alice never gets an opportunity to transmit on the wireless medium. So to solve these three problems, we introduce a new primitive which we call tampered evident messages. It has three properties. First, it cannot be altered without being detected at the receiver. Second, it cannot be hidden from the receiver. And finally, it cannot be prevented from being transmitted on the wireless medium. Let's see how we can achieve these three properties. First, how do we protect from message altering? We're going to exploit a well-known wireless property which states that we cannot generate silence from energy. That is, we cannot cancel out energy on the wireless medium. So say this is Alice's message. We are going to force Alice to follow this message by a message-specific silence pattern. To generate this silence pattern, Alice is going to compute the hash of her message payload, such that the output has an equal number of zeros and ones. Say this is Alice's hash. Now, for every one in the hash function, Alice is going to transmit a random packet, and for every zero, she's going to remain silent. So in our example, because the first bit is a one, Alice is going to transmit a packet, the second is a zero, she's going to remain silent, the third is a one, she's going to transmit a packet, and so on. To see why this protects from message altering, say the adversary is trying to alter the content of Alice's message. It now has to follow this altered message with a new silence pattern that corresponds to the altered message. However, the hash of Alice's original message wouldn't match the hash of the altered message. And therefore, Alice's one bits start showing up in the adversary's silence slots. Since from a wireless property, we cannot generate silence from these one bits. And as a result, the hash doesn't match and Bob would detect tampering. So all the adversary can do is either reiterate this message or confirm this message, but he cannot really alter it. So this simple message configuration would allow the receiver to detect any kind of an altering on the wireless medium. Next, how do we protect from message hiding? All the adversary can do is transmit at the same time as Alice and create collisions with Alice's transmissions. Since collisions are typical events in wireless networks, which are usual, Bob is going to ignore these collisions and hence miss Alice's messages. To protect from this, we are going to associate our message with something unusual. In particular, Alice is going to transmit an extremely long synchronization packet, which is longer than any typical wireless collision. Now, Bob is going to look for this long burst of energy and associate them with an attempt to transmit a pairing message. Since the content of the synchronization packet is random, an adversary cannot really cancel it out. Also, the adversary cannot hide this packet using collisions because it's longer than any typical collision. So all the adversary can do is transmit his own synchronization packet, but then that would be detected as a burst of energy and wouldn't hide that some pairing message was sent. Okay, so finally, how do we ensure that the adversary cannot prevent Alice from sending the message? This is in fact very simple. Alice is going to time out after a known period and transmit on the wireless medium even if the channel is occupied. So even if the adversary is transmitting all the time, Alice would get an opportunity to transmit at some point. So we have a message structure which can neither be altered, hidden, or prevented without being detected at the receiver. But there is still one issue with this message, in that it is susceptible to unintentional tampering. In particular, 802.11 devices transmit on the wireless medium when they see that it's unoccupied. Now if we go back to our tamper evident messages, it has silence periods during the hash bits. Other 802.11 devices in the vicinity are going to look at the silence periods and assume that the channel is unoccupied. So they're going to transmit at the same time, leading to collisions. So we are going to have a large number of false positives. Because the receiver cannot distinguish unintentional tampering from the presence of an adversary. So to protect from unintentional tampering, we're going to exploit a feature of 802.11 called the CTS packet. The CTS packet is used to reserve channel on the wireless medium. In particular, Alice is going to transmit a CTS packet, reserving the channel for the duration of the hash bits. Now, honest 802.11 devices, which are going to listen to the CTS packet, are going to back off and do not transmit during the hash bits, thus solving the problems of unintentional tampering. Okay, now that we have this tamper evident message primitive, let's see how we can construct an in-band secure pairing protocol. So say we have Alice and Bob as before. Let's see what is happening at Alice and Bob as a function of time. The industry already requires the users to push buttons to initiate pairing and requires the users to push these buttons within a period of 120 seconds. So say the user first pushes a button on Alice. Alice is now going to transmit a request message using our tamper-evident message primitive. Now the user is going to push a button on Bob within 120 seconds. Once the button is pushed, Bob is going to transmit a reply message, again using our tamper-evident message primitive. At this point, Alice is going to time out after a period which is much greater than the 120 seconds. Now, in this window of time, Alice is going to check if it has received exactly one reply message and that it has not detected any tampering. If this is the case, Alice is going to proceed with pairing, otherwise she's going to abort. Similarly, Bob is also going to time out after a point and use the same rule as Alice. To see why this protects from man-in-the-middle attacks, say we have an adversary who sends a reply packet even before the user pushes the button on Bob. Since Alice is going to wait for the timeout period, Alice is going to see two reply packets, one from Bob and the other from the adversary, and hence it does not proceed with pairing. Now, say that the adversary tries to tamper with Bob's message, reply message, either by trying to hide it or by trying to alter it. Since Bob's reply message is transmitted using the tamper-evident message primitive, Alice is going to detect this tampering and hence wouldn't pair. In the paper, we describe more details about this protocol to cover all the corner cases and prove the following theorem. If the pairing devices are within radio range and the users press the buttons, then an adversary cannot convince either of these devices to pair with it. We make two main assumptions to prove this theorem. First, the receiver does not confuse the hash packets, that is the 1 bits, for silence, that is the 0 bits. Second, the receiver can detect the synchronization packet. As long as these two assumptions hold, we can prove that TEP is secure against man-in-the-middle attacks. Okay, now let's see how we can implement TEP. We implement TEP on the 802.11 Linux driver using the Ethereos chipsets. We need to address a couple of challenges for TEP to work in practice. First, to maximize the energy, the wireless utilization, we need to minimize the duration of the hash bits to the smallest limit possible. To schedule these really small hash bits, we use high-definition timers in the kernel, and as a result, achieve a 40 microsecond hash bit. So say if we have 128-bit hash function, then we can transmit all these hash bits within 5 milliseconds. Next, we need to ensure that the synchronization packet is longer than any packet on the wireless medium. The longest packet duration on the wireless medium is given by the ratio between the maximum size IP packet and the minimum 802.11 bit rate used. This value turns out to be 12 milliseconds, so we set the synchronization packet to be about 17 milliseconds. So if we consider the synchronization packet and the hash bits, then the overall overhead is less than 23 milliseconds. We're going to evaluate two aspects of TEP. First is false negatives, second is the false positives. False negatives happen when an adversary is successful in mounting the man-in-the-middle attack. However, as I told you earlier, we prove that TEP is secure from man-in-the-middle attacks, and therefore the probability of false negatives is exponentially small. This is true as long as the following two assumptions hold. That is, the receiver does not confuse the hash packets with silence, and it can detect the synchronization packet. We're going to evaluate the validity of these two assumptions. Next, false positives can happen when we detect an attack even in the absence of an adversary. We are going to empirically estimate the probability of this false positives in operational networks. First, let's focus on the false negatives. Both these assumptions require us to be able to detect energy on the wireless medium. But as long as we can detect the really small hash bits, we can also use the same detection mechanisms to detect the really long synchronization packet. So let's first focus on the first assumption, which is, can we distinguish between the one hash bits and the zero hash bits? To do this, we are going to run a couple of experiments on a 12-location test bit which spans more than 20,000 square feet. In every run of the experiment, we are going to randomly pick two nodes to perform pairing. So the question we are going to ask is, can we distinguish between the one and the zero hash bits? On the x-axis, I'm going to plot the normal SSE power of the receiver, and at the y-axis, I'm going to plot the CDF over all locations. Here are the results for the zero bits, and here are the results for the one bits. As we can see, there's a huge gap between the normal SSE power for the zero and one bits. Thus, in practice, the receiver does not confuse the one hash bits with silence. Now that we can detect the really small hash bits, we can use the same detection mechanism to also detect the synchronization packet. Thus, we conclude that in practice, TEP is secure from man-in-the-middle attacks. Next, let's look at false positives. False positives happen when we detect an attack even in the absence of an adversary. This can happen in two cases. First, we confuse cross-traffic energy for synchronization packet. Second, the receiver confuses cross-traffic that corrupts the hash bits for an attack. Let's first evaluate the first case. To check if TEP would mistake cross-traffic energy for synchronization packet, we look at the characteristics of two operational networks, one during SIGCOMM 2010, which is a heavily loaded network, and the other during the MIT network, which is a moderately loaded network. At both these networks, I'm going to plot on the x-axis the continuous energy duration, which we observe in milliseconds, and on the y-axis, I'm going to plot the CDF. Here are the results for SIGCOMM, and here are the results for MIT. As we can see, in both these networks, the maximum energy duration is much smaller than the 17 milliseconds required for a synchronization packet. Thus, we conclude that the studied networks show a zero probability of mistaking cross-traffic for synchronization packet. However, a receiver might still mistake cross-traffic that corrupts the hash bits for an attack. Remember that we use a CTS packet to ensure that other Wi-Fi devices do not transmit during the hash bits. But other non-Wi-Fi devices like Bluetooth do not need to follow the 802.11 protocol and can still transmit. To evaluate the effect of this, we are going to run an experiment where we use two Android phones and we do a bulk data transfer between the two phones using Bluetooth. On the x-axis, I'm going to plot the number of attempts which are required for TEP to be successful in the presence of Bluetooth. And on the y-axis, I'm going to plot the CDF. Here are the results. As we can see, in more than 60% of the cases, TEP is successful in pairing in just one attempt. Further, even in the worst case, TEP does not require more than 4 attempts to successfully pair. This happens because Bluetooth devices are not synchronized with our pairing protocol. Therefore, they do not really interfere with every attempt of pairing. For people who understand Bluetooth, Bluetooth uses frequency hopping, and the hopping pattern changes in every pairing attempt. And therefore, it does not interfere in every pairing attempt. Thus, we conclude that TEP works even in the presence of interference from non-Wi-Fi devices like Bluetooth. Finally, TEP is related to work on secure pairing with out-of-band channels, such as using cameras, audio channels, tactile channels, or even infrared channels. In contrast, TEP is a purely in-band solution. TEP also builds on work on integrity codes, which protects the integrity of the message. However, integrity codes still requires a dedicated out-of-band wireless channel dedicated for pairing. In contrast, we introduce a new perimeter, which we call tamper-evident messages, which not only protects the integrity of the message, but also protects the fact that the message was sent in the first place. This allows us to construct a purely in-band pairing protocol. To conclude, we present TEP, which is the first in-band secure pairing protocol. TEP is secure from man-in-the-middle attacks without requiring out-of-band channels or user passwords. We formally prove that TEP is secure against man-in-the-middle attacks. We also show that TEP can work on existing 802.11 cards and operating systems. Finally, we implement and evaluate TEP on operational Wi-Fi networks. Thank you.
So you claim that there you can always detect an attacker because their silence pattern will not be accurate. However, that is not true if their silence pattern is such that they always transmit for a one bit for every one bit that Alice would have transmitted.
So the thing which I mentioned in passing was that the hash bit should be bit balanced, that it has to have an equal number of zeros and ones, and so that scenario doesn't happen.
Ah, okay. And the other, what if for two different transmitters that cannot see each other but can both see the base station, CTS doesn't work?
So the base station is, so you're talking about the hidden terminals, right, where you have two base stations and which use a CTS?
Well, no. So you have one base station, you have two different clients, but the clients cannot see each other. They're out of range of each other, but they're in range of the base station. Then the non-Alice client will not see the CTS and so can still stop on it.
So one of the approaches to solve that problem is basically first use a CTS packet, and if the client, if the AP is not able to do this for a long time, then he can send a CTS packet during the client CTS packet so that the client, so that the other client wouldn't be able to do it.
So this approach relies on a large timeout. I wonder if you've done any testing to see if users will put up with this, like having to wait for what sounded like 5 to 10 minutes to see.
You're talking about the 120-second timeout?
No, the longer timeout. You said that there was a 120-second timeout to push the second button, and then a much longer timeout within which only one packet could have been received.
The much longer timeout is about 120 seconds plus some epsilon, which is about a couple of
minutes. Okay, so that's a total of 5 minutes that I have to wait to know if my pairing worked.
Yeah, so the way I described the protocol in this talk was a simplified version where we use timeouts, but in the paper we remove the concept of timeouts and just have the user to push another button, and therefore you can do it as fast as the user pushes buttons.
Okay.
So that's, we don't really need any timeouts in the actual protocol, in the full-fledged protocol.
Okay, thank you.
A quick and naive question. So I understand the 2-second timeout, and I understand that the industry sort of specs that out in the current buttons. Would it make it easier if it were 5 minutes? Or what's wrong with setting it like much larger than 2 minutes? Let's say 15 minutes.
If you set it longer timeouts, and the user have to wait for the pairing to complete, right? You don't want that user to wait.
I see. Okay.
That's the reason why you want to eliminate this timeout in the first place.
So in the case where you had the red attacker overwriting the blue with a stronger power. Then you said, okay, but they cannot overwrite the hash bits. Why couldn't they write a longer packet in red that overwrites the hash bits and then write their own hash afterwards,
yeah,
which would be correct?
That's one of the so basically you're talking about what if the two messages are not synchronized, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then you're basically going to detect a synchronization packet which is longer than 17.
Why could the red packet not be longer than the blue one altogether and so cover both the synchronization and everything else?
But then the algorithm at Bob is that if you detect anything which is greater than 17 milliseconds, which is longer than the synchronization packet, you're going to detect an attack. So if the situation which you're talking about happens, and you're going to detect such a long synchronization packet, you're going to detect an attack.
So you mean this packet has to have a specific fixed length?
It's a fixed length, which is 17 milliseconds. If it is longer than that, you're going to detect an attack, because you're going to detect this.
Okay, thanks.
Hi. So you talked about Bluetooth, but this is like 2.4 gigahertz in particular is ISM, so we really don't know what kind of stuff will be on there. There's cordless phones and Zigbee and
actually, that's a great question because we experimented with a couple of more devices like microwave ovens, cordless phones, and baby monitors. So the interesting part about microwave ovens is that it actually has its on-off slots, and it's wherein it transmits interference periodically with a huge amount of silence periods. So the duration of the interference is about less than 6 milliseconds. So we do not really confuse that with a synchronization packet. That's the first point. The one case where you actually do confuse is the baby monitors, because they transmit continuously, and therefore you start detecting false positives. But in that case, we also see that Wi-Fi doesn't work in the first place, because Wi-Fi never gets an opportunity to transmit. So if you have bigger problems to be dealt in that place, that situation.
Okay, thank you.
Great, can we thank the speaker one more time?